You can let Hamas, once Hamas, you can let Hamas have money through Qatar, and he was open about that, because that will keep them quiet. And all we have to do is occasionally go in, and he called it mowing the grass. Namely, you suppress every so often with a very violent reaction. You know, that way is perdition.
Well, we review the past, which is not a happy story, from a day in which there may be some good news, but I think we're all right to be cautious about whether this is more than just a pause and the start of a new peace process. Jonathan Dimbleby, historian, biographer, broadcaster, thanks for joining me today. The new edition of Jonathan's book is The Palestinians. It's an updated edition with a new intro with photographs by Don McCullen, and it's out at the end of October. That's it for me today. Stephen Sacker will be presenting The Times at One next week. But coming up now, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you very much, Andrew. That takes us to 2 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio.
And between now and 4 o'clock, well, as Andrew was saying, there does appear to be a cause for mild optimism today. So as the world waits for the Gaza peace plan to be ratified, we're going to head live to Israel to get reaction from there. And we'll also talk to a man who lost his parents on the 7th of October. The Nobel Prize for Literature has been awarded to a man... Well, let's be blunt about it. You won't have heard of him. We need to find out more. That's later. And Jane Mulcairns will give us a sneak peek of the Saturday Times magazine this week, including whether a dog can basically make your life 1,000,000,000% better and what's happened to Bradley Wiggins. Plus, our big guest is Anne Cleves, the brilliant novelist, with us after 3:30.
And all of that happens after the very latest news with Will Hobbs.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. A spokesperson for Israel's prime minister says Benjamin Netanyahu's objectives have been achieved, confirming the first phase of a peace deal agreed with Hamas has been signed. It's expected to see the release of all Israeli hostages and Palestinian prisoners within days. Israel's deputy foreign minister Sharon Haskell says parts of the agreement have left her feeling uneasy.
It means that there are going to be hundreds of convicted terrorists with blood on their hands who murdered innocent children and women and men that will be released back into society with no restrictions.
Many across Israel and Gaza have been rejoicing at the news. The Prime Minister called it a moment of profound relief. Speaking in India, Donald Trump said it was a great day for the world. Middle East specialist at UCL, Julie Norman, has told Times Radio this could all rest on Donald Trump's patience.
His individual commitment to this is what's going to make or break a deal happening or a deal lasting. How much he would be willing to stay invested through these trickier, thornier, much more detailed, drawn-out negotiations. And I can certainly hope that's the case. I think he sees a lot of interest in the broader region that he wants to see come to bear. And we're all hopeful right now, but also we're realistic that we're dealing with a very different type of American president.
Elsewhere, the sister of Madeleine McCann says a woman claiming to be her missing sibling sent her messages on social media which were creepy. Emily told a jury at Leicester Crown Court there was a sound of desperation to them and the defendant tried to reach her in any way possible, including via LinkedIn. Polish national Julia Wondolt denies stalking the family. Millions of households in England will have to pay even higher water bills than had previously been announced. Five water companies have had their appeals to the Competitions and Markets Authority accepted. It gives them permission to raise bills further. Times Radio's business correspondent is Dominic O'Connell.
They asked for £2.7 billion across the five companies, and what the CMA has approved is £556 million. So they've got about a fifth of what they asked for. That means that there will be an increase in water bills in those five companies, an extra 3%, and they were already going up on average by 24%.
Hate crimes recorded by police in England and Wales are up for the first time in 3 years. The 2% rise includes both racially and religiously motivated offences to 137,000 in the year to March. Hate crimes against Muslims spiked by nearly a fifth, particularly after the Southport murders. Meanwhile, communities in Manchester have been told evil will not prevail as a congregation marks 1 week since a terror attack on a synagogue. Two Jewish worshippers were killed in Crumpsall on the holy day of Yom Kippur. And the Princess of Wales says smartphones and gadgets are creating an epidemic of disconnection. Kate wants people to be more physically present. And don't forget, you can set the Times News Briefing as your flash briefing on Alexa.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
So welcome to what hopefully is a positive afternoon in terms of the geopolitics of the world. It's 4 minutes past two and tracking the peace deal is our most important mission this afternoon. It's where we'll start right away. Also on the programme, we're going to talk to a young woman who's hoping to prize open the door to the rather closed art world in this country. The Nobel Prize for Literature has been announced. We're going to give you a rundown on the winner, and the car finance chaos rumbles on. Are you owed £700? And if you are, how will you get it? How will you know? What are you expected to do? All of those questions will be answered by the fantastic Holly Mead. And after 3:30, we've got a real treat for you if you are a fan of good writing, good crime fiction writing, and Vera off the TV.
Yep. After 3:30 this afternoon, you can relax in the company of Anne Cleves, who is back with a new Jimmy Perez book for the autumn. The Killing Stones is set, though, not on Shetland, but on Orkney. Unfortunately, a murder has occurred, and it is the murder of a man called Archie Stout. Now, he's a difficult character. Some people thought he was the life and soul. Other people didn't like the cut of his jib one bit. But one of his good friends was Jimmy Perez, who is called to Orkney to investigate the murder. So it's fascinating. Anne Cleves is just a good woman. She's a solid citizen who doesn't just write best-selling books and inspire fantastically successful TV shows. She does a lot of work on, well, all sorts of other things, doesn't she? Literacy is one of her big projects, and she's gone into prisons and done work there. She's a big supporter of libraries. She's a really good woman. So Anne Cleves with us after 3:30 this afternoon.
And at what time does the temperature in our studio heat up just a little bit with the arrival of Jane Mulcairns?
Well, I'm just looking at the running order.
I think it's just 45 minutes to go.
I think Jane will be with us. I have to say that I've rather enjoyed reading the articles in the Times magazine, which comes your way, of course, on Saturday. We get a sneak peek today. And they're very good, and there's not really any smart fee.
Okay, so let's see whether or not the smartometer still goes off.
There'll be no klaxon sounding in this week's chat with Jane.
We are going to talk about the front cover pieces about how a dog can mend a broken heart. Yeah. So a little bit of something that will remain cheery is definitely going to be on our agenda this afternoon. We are always 0333 003 2353, and we are always Jane and Fee at times.radio. The most read stories so far today are:
at number three, Victoria Beckham, "My fake boobs, I buried them in Baden Baden." Hilary Rose has written about the former Spice Girls' new Netflix show. Now in it, Victoria Beckham talks about her ego, her eating disorder, her career struggles, and how she just killed off her wag persona. At number two, the second most read story is Gaza ceasefire deal live. Trump says Israel and Hamas agree peace plan. That is the Times live page. You can find all the latest updates on the ceasefire, and we'll obviously cover that story in just a moment here on Times Radio. The most read piece on the Times website is Jeremy Clarkson delighted as Caleb Cooper heads to Australia. Clarkson has probably racked up more air miles than just about anybody else, but his farm manager has never been on a plane before. The 20-hour flight down under might just be a challenge for Caleb, who is going to film a farming documentary. We wish him the very best. You can read all of these articles on thetimes.com. You will need a digital subscription, and you can get one by going to thetimes.com/ subscribe.
So Israel says it has signed the final draft of its ceasefire deal with Hamas ahead of its full ratification this evening. The remaining living hostages are expected to be returned from Gaza by Monday. Explosions, however, continue to be heard across the strip in the run-up to the ceasefire coming into effect. The timeline for signing the deal has been set out by Israeli government spokesperson Shosh Bedrosian.
Tonight at 5 p.m. Israel time, there will be a cabinet meeting. And at 6 p.m. Israel time, there will be a government meeting taking place. Now, within 24 hours after the cabinet meeting takes place, a ceasefire will then begin in Gaza. The IDF will then redeploy to the yellow line as shown on maps, which have been widely distributed at this point in time. And now after this 24-hour period, the 72-hour time window will then begin, where all of our hostages will be released back into Israel.
Sir Keir Starmer has welcomed the breakthrough.
This will come as a profound relief for the hostages and their families and the civilian population in Gaza and for the whole world. And we will now work with our partners to ensure that this deal is implemented in full and without delay.
Well, let's talk more with Yotam Confino, Middle East correspondent and author of Netanyahu's Israel, Rise of the Far Right. Yotam, do you join us from Hostage Square in Tel Aviv?
I am joining you from Hostage Square, where people are quite joyful, obviously very excited, nervous, but most people that I speak to are extremely hopeful that we're finally seeing an end to the two-year war and the release of the hostages on Monday.
We have explained to our listeners the timeline that's expected across the rest of the day. There is still a cabinet meeting that needs to formalise the deal. Is it feasible that the right-wing coalition partners in that cabinet would still be able to stop this?
No. Because there are only two people that are definitely opposed to this deal, and that is the Religious Zionism Party and the Jewish Power Party. But even without those votes, the rest of the government will have a majority to pass this deal. So everyone is expecting that this is going to happen. Netanyahu has also announced it. He wouldn't announce it if he didn't know that he had the necessary votes. So the far-right parties might not be on board. They might even end up leaving his coalition, triggering elections. But we're definitely expecting that they're voting in favor of this peace deal in a few hours.
And is anything, do you think, likely to change in the deal? Or is the formalization literally just that? The actual conditions of this deal will stay?
You know, there are so many things that are still actually not public yet. For example, whether Marwan Barghouti, who is a hero among Palestinians and a terrorist for Israel, someone who's serving life in prison for killing five people in the Second Intifada, will he be on the list of some of those 250 Palestinian prisoners who are said to be released? We don't know that yet. And that is quite a crucial point. It's one of a few points that are left relatively vague, including whether Hamas will disarm, and of course, who's going to be in charge of securing that they have disarmed. But it doesn't matter. Currently, the first phase is agreed on, and the most important thing is happening, which is, of course, in 24 hours, all hostilities will end, more aid will come in, of course, and the release of the hostages. But there are things that can go wrong when you don't have the details completely agreed on. So it is a bit surprising that both Israel and Hamas announced overnight that they had agreed on a deal when there are still quite important details to iron out. I believe it's because they know that they will somehow reach a compromise. They just had to have a little bit more time to find them.
And do you also believe that actually the need to have this deal announced today and formalised by the end of today is to do with the pressure being placed upon Israel by Donald Trump?
I think so, but both Hamas and Israel are under tremendous pressure. Obviously, Donald Trump has told Israel, you need to get this over the line, but he's told Hamas the same. He's also given Hamas a deadline. So both parties knew that they could not drag this on for weeks. Israel also wasn't interested in dragging this on for weeks. So they knew that they had to agree, at least on the first phase, on the very fundamentals of stopping the war. Israel withdrawing to a specific line, which leaves them still in place of roughly half of Gaza, and of course the release of Palestinian prisoners. But the coming hours, the coming days will be extremely crucial, because if something goes wrong, it could potentially derail the whole thing, and then the blame game starts. We've seen that many times before in the last 2 years.
How do you believe that Hamas can be contained in future years? You've got huge expertise of, you know, the dreadful potential that this terrorist organisation has. So I don't want to diminish people's hope and optimism today, but it would be so naive not to have that conversation, wouldn't it?
Look, you're right in asking that question. Absolutely. I don't think that it's right to try and tell the Palestinian and the Israelis that this is going to be peace forever and ever. There is still a terrorist organization that is not going to just hand over their weapons and sing Kumbaya and become a peace organization overnight. That's not going to happen. Hamas, main goal, their raison d'etre, their reason to exist is to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. They have lost the war now. And what I believe is that they're going to take their time. They have plenty of time to slowly but surely lick their wounds, try to recruit new people, do some, obviously some, trying to get some weapons stored here and there. That's what I think is going to happen.
But, what do you think, as well, Yotam, will happen to Benjamin Netanyahu's government now?
Look, I think we're headed for elections. That's the feeling on the ground here in Israel. When Netanyahu announced in the White House all of a sudden that he had agreed to this 20-point plan, everyone in Israel who knows Netanyahu knew that we're headed for elections, because he knows that his far-right coalition partners could potentially topple him. And he's calculating with that risk. Netanyahu is quite risk averse. So he thinks that right now is the time for him to do something that is definitely being welcomed in the Israeli public. There's huge public support for this deal. And if Netanyahu is headed for elections, he's got, as usual, an advantage, because he's the prime minister. He can sell this deal to the public as him being the most responsible prime minister they have to choose from. And he's the most experienced politician by far. So even if polls show that he's currently not going to win, I don't think you should count Netanyahu out, especially not when you have 3 months of election campaigns in Israel.
Yotam, thank you very much indeed for joining us this afternoon. That's Yotam Confino, Middle East correspondent. He's also the author of a book called Netanyahu's Israel. There are a couple of young boys, I'd say aged 8 or 9, who are hanging around the camera behind Yotam giving us the thumbs up. So we send a thumbs up back today. Also on the line is Maoz Inan, an Israeli entrepreneur who lost his parents in the October 7th attack. Maoz, a very good afternoon from us in London. Can I first simply ask you how you're feeling today?
I'm feeling that what we've been working for in the last 2 years, my siblings, the Israeli-Palestinian peace camp, and me personally, is actually happened. We've been working very hard to bring this war to an end and to start a negotiation and a conflict resolution process. And this is exactly what's happening today. And this should be only the first step in profound, invested reconciliation process between the Israelis and Palestinians that will bring a lasting peace and will prevent the next war to happen. And we still got a lot of work to ahead of us, but it's a great first step.
What do you think the key things are that now have to happen in order to ensure a lasting peace?
There are many things. And first, we need to be also aware that the extremists on both sides might try to sabotage this peace process. And we need to keep on working together, the Israelis and Palestinians, to envision a shared future, to envision a better reality, and to continue our efforts and work in making it happen. And we need the international community to be aware and pressure our politicians. It was very clear in the last 2 years that there are no leaders, not in the Israeli society and not in the Palestinian society. We have only politicians that thrive by sacrificing their life. They sacrificed my parents. They sacrificed the hostages. That's from the Israeli side and from the Palestinian side. The Hamas has been sacrificing the life of the civilians in Gaza. And I'm sure those parties will try and continue to sabotage the future we all deserve. A future that is based on equality, on dignity, and security and safety to all.
Do you believe what Yotam said, though, about the turn in favour that will be enjoyed by Benjamin Netanyahu? And you have been critical of his government in the past for sacrificing hostages. So does it slightly irk you that he may benefit politically now, even though he has, in some people's eyes, delayed this moment for his own political gain?
So what I care the most is that the solution will be a political solution, and not solution that is tried to be achieved on the battlefield and by sacrificing people. And after October 7th, I was furious. I was full of anger and hate and wanted to punish and take my revenge in the Israeli government. But through the work I was doing with my Palestinian partners and brothers, I learned that I can choose forgiveness. That I can choose forgiveness in order to save my own soul from the destiny those who are accountable for the death of my parents choose for me. And since then, I've been choosing radical forgiveness. I forgive the Israeli government and I forgive Hamas. I care only about the future. And I don't care who will be credit for achieving a lasting peace and learning about conflict areas around the world, that many times peace treaties are being signed by those who only a day before was still killing and massacring innocent people.
Yeah.
And what I care is only about ensuring a future, ensuring a future of reconciliation, a future of equality, and who will be credit for that? I cannot care less.
Well, I admire your human spirit. You are the best of all of us, without a doubt. But can I ask you whether you believe that the people of Gaza can become strong enough to reject Hamas from within? Because surely the only real way to get a lasting peace is to give strength to the Palestinian people to reject terrorism, to reject violence.
So again, this same question can be asked also to the people of Israel. Are we strong enough to reject Benjamin Netanyahu? And I'm saying again that I could not care less. What is important is that the solution will be a political solution. And Hamas is a fundamental terrorist organization that killed and murdered my parents and so many of my childhood friends, can also change his way. And from being a warmonger and a terrorist organization, it can become a political organization. And it was also proved in Israel in the past. One of our former prime minister, Menachem Begin, who is a Nobel Prize, was a Nobel Prize laureate for signing peace with Egypt in 1977. But till the independence of Israel, till the year of 1948, he was the commander of the Irgun, a terrorist Jewish militia that was in charge for killing innocent people, if it's Palestinians or Brits. And he was a wanted terrorist by the Brits. So he changed his way. Yeah. And I believe like Menachem Begin changed his way and many other terrorists and terror organizations, I believe Hamas can be pressured to change its way and to choose the political way and the political field and not the battlefield and the massacre.
It's so good to talk to you today. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. That's Maoz Innant, who is an Israeli entrepreneur. And as he mentioned there, he lost his parents in the October 7th attack. And I think his journey since then is quite a remarkable one.
Yeah, really impressive man. Now, next on Times Radio, how do you learn to do art? How do you learn to appreciate it and to know exactly what's permissible to say about it? Our guest is going to explain everything next. It is 22 minutes past two. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
The UK's first human heart transplant has been completed, supported by the British Heart Foundation.
We were a noisy generation, but it might be something quiet we do that becomes our greatest legacy. Leave a gift in your will to the British Heart Foundation and fund groundbreaking research that could help save millions of lives. Search BHF Wills.
If you could sail anywhere in the world, where would you go? With Oceania Cruises, our small luxurious ships allow us to dock in boutique ports in 600 stunning destinations. We offer a more immersive experience and a personalized service, creating unique travel memories. From the Caribbean to the Mediterranean and the finest cuisine at sea, it can only be Oceania Cruises. Visit oceaniacruises.com or your travel agent.
At Buy Association, we stay one step ahead of the property market, which is why our award-winning consultants know that Manchester has recently overtaken London as the UK's top hotspot for residential property. With an ever-expanding city centre, new transport links and a booming rental market, the smart money really is in Manchester. Discover why more and more people are choosing Manchester and request your free property guide today. Text BA Radio to 66777. Buy Association. Rated excellent on Trustpilot.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Our guest is Kate Bryan, who is an art historian and the author of a new book called How to Art, which is a guide to making art just accessible, enjoyable and available to all for all. I've just been at Jenny has WhatsApped Kate to say, surely doing art and critiquing art are two different things. Yes, absolutely right, Jenny. It's just that I was trying to do something witty with the name of the book. I wish I hadn't bothered now. Kate, tell us about you, first of all, and how you're able to write this book about how to art.
Well, I'm someone that just grew up just loving art. It just made total sense to me. Every day I drew and painted, and then I didn't really know anything about art history as a discipline, but I discovered it existed just as I was about to go to university. And I just thought, oh, that makes so much sense, like seeing the world through the eyes of artists, understanding history through the prism of art. And so I studied art history, and then I finally got into the art world after lots of false starts. But anyway, started making tea and coffee at the British Museum. I finally got there. Mm-hmm. And I realised I'd entered quite an elitist world, and I thought...
Well, quite... Yeah. I mean, it's got to be the elitist world, surely.
I don't know. I mean, I'm really terrified of opera, aren't you?
That's yes, quite, I am. Good
master, point. Wine tasters, master sommeliers, also terrifying. Okay. But anyway, but no, it is elitist, isn't it? And I had no idea, and I didn't realise it was also sort of driven with all these sort of class issues, and it's about power and status. And actually, a lot of it is about excluding people. And it broke my heart, because I just thought, there's one thing that unites all of us is making art. We all make art as children. We're not singing opera. We're not wine tasting. At least I hope we're not.
You speak for yourself, Kate. In the suburbs of Liverpool, we did nothing but sing opera from a very early age. Let's talk about the fact that, as actually in this country, one of our many, many boons is that you can access so much brilliant art and it costs you nothing. Mm. So people are put off going, partly because they don't want to be judged by what they might say or think about a particular piece.
Yeah, and I think that was the reason why I wanted to write the book so much, is I would encounter people all the time and they would say something like, oh, I really like David Hockney or Tracy Emin. I don't know anything about art, but I like them. But you'd never say, oh, I really like Coldplay, but I don't know anything about music. And I just felt that people certainly have this art anxiety. We did a YouGov survey this summer before the book came out, because I have all this sort of anecdotal chat about art, as we all do in the worlds that we're in. Mm. And I thought, I want some facts to back this up. So we asked people if they'd taken a kid to a gallery in the last, well, ever, actually. Yeah. And 15% of people in the UK had ever taken a child to a gallery, which is just tiny considering these are spaces that are free. And it's also always raining here, and it's a great place to go over the weekend.
And there's usually a cafe.
Exactly.
There's sometimes slightly high prices in the cafe. Yeah. But at least it's a place to shelter.
Exactly. And they're amazing places. And we do have an incredible national collection. And when those people were asked, would you like to take your child to a gallery or a child to a gallery? Most of the respondents said yes. But it was, you'd think that time would be a barrier to access. 19%, I think, said time was a problem. Slightly higher was confidence. So people just didn't feel confident enough to go to these spaces. And what I'm trying to say to people is you don't have to read 200 art history books or even one art history book to have a relationship with art. You can take it exactly on your own terms. Like, I'm very good at drinking Chablis and Sancerre. Can I tell them apart? Barely. Do I try and stick to about 10, 12 pounds? Don't know anything about grapes or vineyards or sunshine or France. No, I just like wine and I'm allowed to just like wine.
When did you first feel confident enough to diss the work of a major artist?
Probably quite young, knowing me. At university, I remember thinking, right, Picasso's a bit of a piece of work. Also,
I think he's rubbish, I'll be honest.
He's also a creative revolutionary, but yeah, total arse to women.
But also, is it pleasurable to look at his work?
It can be. I mean, I think that one of the things I wanted to talk about a lot in the book is that you don't have to like it all. You know, Alan Bennett, the great playwright, says every museum and gallery above the door should say you don't have to like it all. And I really think that's important because, you know, I'll go home tonight and watch something on Netflix or I'll eat a meal or I'll listen to music and I'll know that whether I like something or I don't like something or whether I'm prepared to push through and learn a bit more about something. And I just want people to understand the exact same principle applies with art.
So there is no wrong thing to say.
There's no wrong thing to say. And actually, David Shrigley, who's illustrated the book, who's an amazing contemporary artist, he says there's no such thing as good art and bad art. There's just the art that you like and the art that you don't like.
And if you happen to see something, let's say you're exploring a second-hand shop, some sort of, set of stalls over the weekend. I think it's called a market. Just groping for the word. And you see something and it's 40 quid. And for whatever reason, it has a message for you. I mean, it could be worth a lot more. It might be worth a lot less. But if you like it, you should buy it, shouldn't you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that there's no such thing as a sort of absolute value judgment. And on my house, on the walls of my house, I have, serious art by artists, blah, blah, blah. But I also have the stuff that my daughter's done that I think is particularly good. I have things that my mum's done on a painting course. And these are all treasured things. I think that everybody should be able to think, to free ourselves from, I think, what has happened to the art world is it's become sort of rampantly commercial and very intellectual. And those things are fine. You know, I'm not trying to tear down the art world. I just want to kind of open the doors to other possibilities and other avenues. Because if we're constantly terrified of it, then less and less of us are going to have a relationship with it. And it's really good for us. It's great to have a relationship with art.
Now, I gather there is some sort of car boot art sale that makes buying art really accessible. I'd never heard of this. Are they everywhere?
I think they're only in London. They should do them more. But yeah, it's something called the Art Car Boot. So back in the original one, I think you had like Tracy Emin showing work in literally a car boot, which is just so British and lovely and charming and bohemian. And there's something called the Other Art Fair. I mean, I always advocate for people to go to open artist studios. So wherever you are in the world, Google an artist studio block. It's great. You know, you'll be served some of the warmest, most disgusting white wine of your life, but you'll meet all the artists. They'll all be in the same building. You can move between spaces, see you who you like, don't you like. You don't have to buy anything, but if you do buy anything, it will probably be very inexpensive. You know, it's very possible to buy inexpensive art.
Are you an artist yourself?
No, well, I made art the whole time as a child, and then I studied art history and then got terrified of it and thought I'm just not good enough, so I'll just talk about it all the time. But actually, since having a child, I make a lot more art. And I realise, God, I've been really missing this. You know, it's very pleasurable. You don't have to be Adele to sing karaoke. And I'm certainly no Adele. But, you know, it's fun to sing karaoke. It's fun to make a painting, even if you don't love it that much at the end.
Yeah. Well, it's been lovely to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Art historian Kate Bryan, her book How to Art is a guide to making art and the subject of art accessible to all. And it's out now.
I tell you what, we're terribly cultured this afternoon because after the latest news headlines from Will Hobbs, we're going to continue our Nobel Prize series by talking about literature. It's just gone 2:30 with Jane and Fee on Times Radio.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Here are your headlines at 2:31. Benjamin Netanyahu is due to meet his cabinet shortly to ratify a deal that will lead to the release of Israeli hostages held by Hamas. Hostages could be freed in days if Netanyahu's government signs President Trump's ceasefire deal, but there are no guarantees for the Israeli Prime Minister. Judy Norman is a Middle East specialist at UCL. She says it was unexpected to get to this stage so quickly.
This hostage release and prisoner release for Hamas was something that both sides really wanted. Trump really wanted it. And this was one piece that I think we were hopeful could get over the line this week. The fact that it did in just a matter of days, I would say, was a bit surprising, but obviously great relief that it did, certainly in Israel for hostages coming home. And I would say across much of Palestine also for what's expected to be close to 2,000 detainees and prisoners to be released as well.
Elsewhere, Madeleine McCann's sister's giving evidence in a trial over two women accused of stalking her family. Amelie McCann, who's 20, has said that one of the women, aged 24, contacted her directly on Facebook, claiming she was Maddie and that she remembered playing Ring of Roses with her and her brother. Vigils and demonstrations are being held across the UK a week on from a deadly attack at a synagogue in Manchester. Jihad al-Shami pledged allegiance to so-called Islamic State as he tried to get into the building in Crumpsall. Two people died. And Sir Keir Starmer's announced plans to review licensing rules for pubs in England and Wales, which could include longer opening hours. It's understood he'll also look into making it easier for bars to host live music and food pop-ups. For a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Life's like a photo album. Mine bring back so many memories. That's a street party on VE Day. Me, 3 years old. Well, here's me, 17, teddy boy. Our wedding. Didn't my Shirley look lovely? Holiday in Devon when the boys were small. They tower over me now. Oh, now these are the more recent ones on my phone. Oh, that's me and Kate enjoying a game of cards. She's my care professional from home instead. Kind, funny and very good at gin rummy. Since Shirley passed away, Kate comes to the house most days to help with the things I can't manage so well now. She's great company. I mean, the boys visit me most weekends, but they can't be here all the time, so home instead have really helped. I have the best quality care, but in my own home, from Kate. She's wonderful. Though she will have to let me win at cards now and again.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Can your phone drown out irritating noises in your videos? Can anybody hear me over this? Luckily, Audio Eraser on the Galaxy S25 Ultra gets rid of background noises in seconds. Can your phone do that? Galaxy can. Get 15% off Galaxy S25 Ultra with code S15.
Buy from Samsung.com by the 21st of October 2025. Use code at checkout. Voucher code can't be combined with any other offer. Samsung account login and network connection required. Certain types of noise can be detected. Accuracy not guaranteed.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms. Ready to start your next home project? This autumn at Wickes, there are great kitchen and bathroom offers available. Explore the ranges at wickes.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wickes store.
John Pienaar is going to have a very busy afternoon. So obviously we are tracking any developments in the peace deal that needs to still be ratified. Some other things may happen in your time. Who will you speak to?
Well, so look, when we come on, we're expecting Donald Trump to chair a meeting of his cabinet, which will be another stage for him to have his say on what's going on. And of course, he's going to, as it were, just bathe in that arc light, and just and the congratulations for his leading role in bringing about this peace agreement. And he did play such a leading role in doing that. It is an enormous contrast with what Joe Biden was able to do or felt able to do. And yeah, I mean, clearly Donald Trump, while he was doing this, pushing this deal, he had one eye on his place in a history book and another eye on a Nobel Peace Prize. But we are where we are now. And so we're going to be talking about, you know, where we are now, watching the celebrations, the process of getting the peace formally put into place and looking into the future. Because whichever way you look at it, it is fragile. And I think when you talk to all these people who are steeped in the subject, who spent years watching it so up close and personal, all of that experience has woven a sort of a blanket of scepticism and doubt about what might be possible in the future, you know, despite the hopes, which are always going to exert themselves. So I'm going to be talking to former spokesman from the Israeli government, for the Israeli military. I'm talking to one of the NGO leaders there, and American politicians and former politicians. I mean, so much to cover in the time that we've got, as the story is playing out in real time.
So John will be here from 4 o'clock this afternoon on Times Radio. His show goes through until 7. Now, the winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature has been announced. The prize, an annual test of whether you can really call yourself a true reader, has been awarded to the Hungarian writer Laszlo Krasznahorkai. We haven't been lucky enough to read his works. Definitely going to go on a list. That's correct, isn't it, Jane?
Very much so.
Let's talk to Jacob Brogan, who's book world editor at The Washington Post. Hello, Jacob.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's absolutely our pleasure. So Jane and I are both ignorant. We aren't reading at the right kind of level, I think, for the Nobel Prize for Literature. Can you tell us a little bit more about the Hungarian winner?
Sure. I mean, Krasznahorkai is, even by the kind of recondite standards of the Nobel Prize for Literature, a difficult choice. He's famous for writing these books with sprawling sentences that sometimes run to dozens of pages, or in the case of his novel that was most recently translated into English, Hearst 07769, hundreds of pages. That book is more than 400 pages long and is a single sentence throughout. His themes are apocalyptic. He's interested in the ways that sort of almost demonic forces enter into already dilapidated, depopulated, destroyed communities and worlds and manipulate them. But despite all of that, he's also very funny, very lively, and a writer who believes deeply in, I think, the power and pleasure even of art. So in Hearst 07769, the book that most likely won him in some ways the Nobel Prize, even though the Swedish Academy technically gives it for a body of work, we follow a character named Florian, a sort of gentle giant living in Germany, who believes that Bach, the music of Bach, will be the one thing that stops us from the sort of quantum destruction of the world, which he's trying to warn Angela Merkel about in a series of letters. But at the same time, he's oblivious to the fact that he's friends with a group of neo-Nazis and is sort of unwittingly abetting their rise to power and their terrorism of this community that he loves and is part of. So it's a book about our kind of tenuous, strange, oblivious relationship to authoritarianism. And it's also ultimately a book about the troubling seductions of redemptive or ostensibly redemptive violence. It's difficult, but it's quite beautiful. It's funny, and it's lively, as are many of his books.
Okay. Well, we are certainly better informed for you having explained all of that to us. And of course, those are really important themes. But in other prizes for literature, there is an element of popularity, of readability. And sure. Is it fair to say that the Nobel Prize just doesn't really have to concern itself with those things? It's not what it's awarding the prize for.
No, I mean, you know, I think that, I mean, certainly it has had its share of popular writers over the years. Even the American writer Bob Dylan won several years ago. But it is interested in matters of style, in matters of literary form. I mean, I point to Jan Fosse, who won in 2023, who similarly is a writer who writes in kind of sprawling sentences. His book, Septology, which is really seven novels in a single volume, as it's normally read, is also one single sentence. And there the effect is quite different than Krasznahorkai, but it is, of course, challenging to sort of make your way through it. And I don't think that that troubles them. If anything, perhaps they do seek that out, that difficulty. But at the same time, they're inviting us by giving the prize, I think, to discover writers who are the kind of people we might not otherwise pick up. I think there's something quite wonderful about that.
And do you know much about Mr. Krasznahorkai as a person?
You know, I don't know a ton about him as a person. I've heard from those who've spoken to him that he's surprisingly charming and funny and lively, or maybe not surprising since his work is all of that too, in person, that he's a great conversationalist. I've never encountered him myself. He's Hungarian, obviously, and is known in part, in addition to his fiction, for his collaborations with the great filmmaker, Hungarian filmmaker Bela Tarr, Perhaps most notably for the film Satan Tango, which is based on Krasznahorkai's first novel, which of the same name, Satan Tango. The film of Satan Tango runs to 7.5 hours long and is absolutely worth seeing if you can find the time to sit through it.
Right, okay, so this is a guy who likes his books, his sentences and his films to be long. And I don't want to sound facetious in asking this question, but in Hearst 07769, the book that you've been talking about, that is just one great big sprawling sentence, as a reader, how do you navigate that? I mean, when do you think, okay, I've read enough tonight, I can just put this down?
So when I was reading it last year to review it, what I looked for were the moments where there was a semicolon all of a sudden, which is about as close as he comes to something like a full stop until the final page of the book. And if you look through the copy I used when I was preparing to review it, there are little marks on certain pages, just little slashes in the middle of the pages where I stopped, because there's sort of no way to find a spot otherwise. You know, when we talk about unputdownable work as critics, normally we mean that it's just sort of thrilling, that it keeps you going, that you want to know what happens next. And with Krasznahorkai, it's unputdownable because it's very hard to find a place where you're sort of allowed to put it down.
Okay. Lovely to talk to you, Jacob. Thank you very much indeed for that. That's Jacob
Brogan,
who is book world editor at the Washington Post. Will Self wrote a book in that style, didn't he? Which was just one long sentence start to finish, I think. Was it Phone?
Yeah. I think he's still waiting to hear from the Nobel Committee, isn't he? But that was really interesting. So now we know all about the winner of this year's Nobel Prize for Literature, and well done him. Nafisa has sent us an image of, I think it's a watercolour, could be an oil painting, I'm not quite sure, something she wanted to know if, I'll get this right eventually, our art expert, Kate Bryan, could have a look at this work of art, which is a rather sort of stormy autumnal scene. And Nafisa's just started doing an art class and she wanted to know what our art expert thought of it. Well, the good news, Nafisa, is that Kate has had a look and she thinks you've got potential. She described your picture as having a condensed energy. So take that away and keep going, because she thinks you've got something. Thank you for sending that in. Now, Pope Leo says the Catholic Church's core mission is to help the poor, the downtrodden and migrants. He said this in his first major papal publication. It's rather put him at odds with some conservative Catholics who want him to prioritise doctrine and dogma instead. Let's go to Rome and talk to the Times' Tom Kington. Why is this controversial? It doesn't seem to be controversial on the face of it.
No, I mean, it's the Pope saying, look after the poor. You'd imagine that that's kind of business as usual. But this comes against a background of him taking over the reins from Pope Francis, who very much focused on the sort of social outreach of the church, which irked conservative Catholics who were saying, well, look, the Catholic Church is not just an NGO. It's not a charity. It's not just there to sort of feed the poor. We've got to focus on praying and doctrinal business, you know, being a little bit more academic. And so there was great expectation for what how Pope Leo would you know, get going. And with his first big text, which was published today, he seems to be very keen to just follow the same path as Francis. So this is a very sort of strident piece of writing saying, look, don't separate doctrine from caring for the poor. They're one and the same. Caring for the poor is doctrine. That's his point.
It's a very interesting time, isn't it? Because a lot of right-wing political forces are very keen to discuss their passion for Christianity, but perhaps not this sort of Christianity.
Correct. I mean, it's interesting that before he became Pope, Leo, then Cardinal Robert Prevost, who is the first American Pope, of course, had a pop at Vice President J.D. Vance, who himself is a Catholic and who had marshalled some bits and pieces of sort of Catholic philosophy to argue that one could sort of prioritize love for one's neighbor so that you could sort of extend your charity to your family and your friends, and then not so much to the people living on the corner, and much less to perhaps migrants. And the future Pope Leo at the time brought back saying, no, look, love for one's fellow man is equal across the board. You can't prioritize these things.
Yes. Leo has written, no Christian can regard the poor simply as a societal problem. Charity is not optional, but a requirement of true worship. To go back to what we said earlier, it seems entirely reasonable for the head of a church. What, if anything, happens now?
Well, I think that it'd be interesting to see how the conservative Catholics, and there are plenty in the US, react to this. There have already been quite a lot of grumblings about previous things he said about migrants, obviously, you know, against the context of Donald Trump's big crackdown. I mean, we could end up just going back to business as was under Francis, where the hardline Catholics, particularly in the US, just hated him. And that was an issue, I think, for the Catholic Church, because a lot of money, a lot of the donations that the Catholic Church relies on come from wealthy backers in the US. And so we could see this time around Pope Leo trying to avoid that predicament where a lot of the big money is kind of throttled at source.
Right. Interesting. Thank you very much indeed. The Times correspondent in Rome, that was Tom Kington.
Two differing views this afternoon from two of our listeners. Jane says some of us have heard of Krasna Hawkeye and have even read some in translation. I confess, much as I love dear lamented Jilly Cooper, some of your listeners do go beyond. But Paul says, Times Radio, one 400-page sentence, why? Could it possibly be pretentious twaddle? Do keep them coming. It's 0333 003 2353. Coming up, which famous Olympian snorted cocaine off his gold medal? It's not a competition. Don't phone in with an answer. This is Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with Barclays Corporate Banking. This afternoon from 4, join John Pienaar for well-informed debate, insight and analysis that brings the big political picture sharply into focus. From global events on the international stage to issues closer to home. John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with Barclays Corporate Banking. See tomorrow clearly with Big Picture Banking from Barclays. Find out more at barclayscorporate.com/thetimes.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Listeners, we interrupt the airwaves to share an incredible discovery. The reason why Britain hasn't been so great of late is because the country hasn't been eating enough Weetabix. We must get to work in rebuilding Great Britain, Bix by Bix. By delivering Weetabix to whoever plans the traffic diversions, to delivery drivers who can't seem to find your house,
and people who don't stack the dishwasher properly.
To Britain, we must say, have you had your Weetabix?
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
You never forget the dogs you've loved. They have the power to steal our hearts, to love us unconditionally, and be there for us when we need them most, without saying a word. You understand how a dog can change a life. A guide dog can transform the life of someone living with sight loss. Will you help change someone else's life with a gift in your will to guide dogs? Request our free will guide today. Search Guide Dogs Free Wills.
Guide Dogs. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Now, on the whole, this programme is dog positive. Fee has her lovely greyhound, Nancy, don't you? How old is Nancy now?
Oh, Nancy's coming up for 13. She is in her dotage, yep.
Right. Well, Jane Mulcairns joins us.
Also 13, sort of.
You're so not in your dotage.
Oh, definitely not that.
No, never.
And the reason I mention pooches is because Jane's here to talk. She's the associate editor of The Times magazine. She's here to talk about what awaits us as we wake up on Saturday morning in the mag this week. And there is such a beautiful picture in the magazine of a lovely dog peering from quite an expensive weekend bag, I think that's right. And it's Sophia Money Coutts's dog, Dennis.
Yeah.
And she's written about Dennis because?
Well, because Dennis has helped her through a difficult time. So on the cover of the magazine, which we haven't seen because for some reason it hasn't turned up yet today, there is a picture of Dennis and Sophia. Sophia with her very long, long legs, looking amazing. But the picture you're referring to, which is on the inside, it is a dog in a bag. And Dennis looks very cosy in that little bag. And the headline inside is, "Can a tiny terrier mend a broken heart?" I mean, the short answer is, partially, yes.
Yeah.
The long answer is that Sophia has written a whole book about the first year with Dennis. And it was a tricky year because she got Dennis when she was in the throes of a, you know, really big romance with a man who I think she thought she could see herself building a future with, and certainly was considering having a family with. And that's also kind of why she felt able to get a dog. And then 3 months into having Dennis, the boyfriend broke up with her, and it was really Dennis who sort of helped her through all the stages of grief, including spending her 40th birthday with just Dennis, making a steak for dinner, watching telly. I mean, it's a very, very funny read because Sophia is a brilliant writer and she's been very honest about the ups and downs of a breakup and, you know, dog ownership.
Well, what this article does make clear is that I've never, as a grown-up, owned a dog, so I haven't got a puppy in my adult life. I've only ever had cats. You really do have to put a shift in when you get a tiny puppy, don't you?
Although I have to say, just bringing things bang up to date, I met Dennis this morning. He came to the office with Sophia, not on his own. and Sophia and I were recording a podcast together, and he is so well behaved. He sat in the recording studio for 45 minutes, didn't bark, didn't object to anything.
No.
Didn't have a lot to contribute either, I have to say. Could have done better.
What brand of dog is Dennis?
He's some sort of terrier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's quite small.
He is smallish. That's the thing. I'm not normally fond of small dogs, but he is a lovely one. Anyway, he's a beautiful dog. He's really well behaved. And Sophia is very well indeed. And she actually just texted me with a picture of Dennis on the tube looking, you know, very well behaved and lovely. And she said, who needs boyfriends anyway?
Yeah, well, it turned out that Dennis was an absolute keeper.
Yeah.
And that's good. Right, OK, Bradley Wiggins is somebody who features in the magazine this week. He has written a book, which I must admit, I think I'll probably will read now on the strength of this interview. Cycling, I know it's hugely popular. It's not my favourite sport, but he was always a standout participant and, of course, a phenomenal British Olympian.
Yeah, absolutely.
But what a story.
Yeah, so about 2.5 years ago, Polly Vernon interviewed Bradley for the magazine, and quite unexpectedly, Bradley opened up about the sexual abuse that he'd suffered from at the hands of a coach when he was a young cyclist as a teenager. And Polly writes in this piece that it was the most distressing, sort of most raw interview of her career. She wasn't expecting it to come in this interview. He'd never spoken about it before, and he really just kind of opened up to her. But what he didn't tell her in that interview was he was also at that time when they spoke in the throes of a huge cocaine addiction as well. And in this interview, and so he's written a book now about everything really from sort of his childhood in Kilburn and how he was bullied. His stepfather was violent. His own father had disappeared when he was 18 months old. They'd never had a relationship, all the way through, you know, becoming an Olympian and the highs and the lows of that career. And then his kind of descent into addiction after he retired from the sport. I mean, it's some of the details in it really are astonishing. The amount of drugs he was taking and the kind of the sort of brutality, really, with which he was treating himself.
Well, let me just read you this little bit. The reality, this is an extract from his book, which is coming out, well, it's presumably out very soon. He says, the reality of cocaine is finding yourself hunched in a toilet cubicle, knees in somebody else's urine, snorting a line off a lavatory seat. Glamorous it ain't.
No.
I mean, it really does sound like he's really, really explicit and properly hard on himself here.
Well, I mean, several times in the interview, Polly sort of says, you know, you don't have to blame yourself quite so much. But he does. He really does sort of blame himself for a lot of it. And he says he never wants to be seen as a victim or to be, you know, blaming somebody else, even though obviously he wasn't responsible for the abuse that he suffered as a child or his dad leaving when he was a child. And all of that stuff has, you know, left incredible scars. And I don't know. I mean, I think the more and more I know about the extraordinary success of Olympic champions, or, you know, people have incredible success in music or film when they're quite young. It's just so lonely. And he talks about that a lot, the loneliness of his success compounded with, you know, an awful lot of trauma that he went through as a child, all unresolved. Yeah, it did lead to, you know, quite the downfall afterwards. The good news is he's been sober for a year now. He's been clean. And interestingly, one of the people who helped him with that was Lance Armstrong. Read an awful lot of good stuff about Lance Armstrong. So that was nice to hear.
Well, I was impressed by the fact that Armstrong did properly reach out at a time when nobody else was very much interested.
Yeah, absolutely. He says that Lance Armstrong reached out, offered, you know, invited him to America, offered to help him out with money, has been an incredible sport. He does say he's Lance Armstrong, he's got an ego, but he says he was genuinely kind and shows him extreme generosity at a time when he really needed it. It's an incredible read, and you just wish that Bradley Wiggins would show himself a little bit of compassion, you know, going forward, because he's opened up talking about stuff that a lot of men would find very, very difficult to. And he's really sort of put it out there. And
it's still very early days, though, isn't it? To have revealed something like that. Maybe that comes a bit further down the line.
Maybe.
We should say that the grotesque individual who abused him is dead. So, but never, he never got any justice, did he?
No. But he says that he's not sure whether that's a good or a bad thing, because it would be terrible to face someone who'd done that to you and for them to deny it. So he thinks that perhaps just the fact that he's no longer around is the justice that he wants.
His book is called The Chain, and just to get this right, it's out on October the 23rd. And finally, just a quick word about Bill Bryson, who is back. This is quite a funny interview. His book about the history of everything is coming out again.
Yes, the updated history of everything. Bill Bryson seems to retire every other year, and he's brought himself out of retirement to write another book, which is an update to his best-selling science book, A Short History of Everything. It's a great interview by, I would say, probably the Times' very own Bill Bryson, Tom Whipple.
Yeah.
It's a great chat between two enormous brains. Bill Bryson does promise it his last book, but who can take his word for it?
Do you think it is his last book?
I mean, well, there are fingers that work and words that exist. I mean, I wouldn't like to put a bet on it, Jane.
Right, OK. Or indeed, was that his last interview? You want to make sure you read it, just in case it is his last ever interview. Bill Bryson talking to Tom Whipple in the Times magazine, which is available as part of your Times bundle. And it just enlivens your Saturday morning, doesn't it? Thank you, Jane.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
That takes us to 3 o'clock. It is Jane and Fee with you until four. In the next hour of the programme, Jimmy Perez is back on Orkney this time for another Anne Cleves feast. And Anne is our guest after 3:30. Also, are you owed 700 quid on car finance compensation? How will you get it if you are? And more from Israel on the proposed peace deal. Let's get the very latest news headlines with Will Hobbs.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Israel says it has signed the final draft of its ceasefire deal with Hamas ahead of its full ratification this evening. The remaining living hostages are expected to be returned from Gaza by Monday. The timeline for signing the deal has been set out by Israeli government spokesperson Shosh
Bedrosian.
Tonight at 5 p.m. Israel time, there will be a cabinet meeting. And at 6 p.m. Israel time, there will be a government meeting taking place. Now, within 24 hours after the cabinet meeting takes place, a ceasefire will then begin in Gaza. The IDF will then redeploy to the yellow line as shown on maps, which have been widely distributed at this point in time. The 72-hour time window will then begin, where all of our hostages will be released back into Israel.
Middle Eastern correspondent Yotam Confino says people in Israel and Gaza are rejoicing, but says a sense of realism is also required.
Hamas' main goal, their raison d'etre, their reason to exist, is to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. They have lost the war now, and what I believe is that they're going to take their time to slowly but surely lick their wounds, try to recruit new people, do some, obviously some, trying to get some weapons stored here and there. That's what I think is going to happen.
Speaking from India, Sakir Starmer has thanked Donald Trump for his leadership and called the agreement a moment of profound relief for the world. Elsewhere, the sister of Madeleine McCann is a 24-year-old woman claiming to be her missing sibling, sent her messages on social media which were creepy. 20-year-old Amelie told a jury at Leicester Crown Court there was a sound of desperation to them, and the defendant tried to reach her in any way possible, including via Facebook and LinkedIn. Polish national Julia Wondolt denies stalking the family. People are gathering in Manchester on a day of solidarity to remember the bravery of the victims of a terror attack on a synagogue last week. Jihad al-Shami targeted the Jewish community in Crumpsall on the holy day of Yom Kippur, in which two men died. Rafi Bloom is on the board of the Jewish Representative Council in Manchester. He told the crowds they must never be forgotten.
A week ago, the moment we had all feared and had warned our political leaders about came true with horrific consequences. We stand here today to pay tribute to them, pray for their souls, and remember their sacrifice.
Hate crimes recorded by police, meanwhile, in England and Wales are up for the first time in 3 years. The 2% rise includes both racially and religiously motivated offences to 137,000 in the year to March. Hate crimes against Muslims sparked by nearly a fifth, particularly after the Southport murders. And Sakir Starmer's announced plans to review licensing rules for pubs in England and Wales, which could include longer opening hours. It's understood he'll also look into making it easier for bars to host live music and food pop-ups. The Prime Minister described pubs as the beating heart of communities in the UK. And don't forget, you can set the Times news briefing as your flash briefing on Alexa.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon. We're here until 4 o'clock. John Pienaar takes over then. And between now and four, we have Anne Cleaves, the brilliant writer, the creator of Vera Stanhope, and indeed the creator of Jimmy Perez. And it's Jimmy Perez she's focused on now, because she has a new Perez novel out. Normally, Perez carries out his detective work on Shetland, but in this new book, The Killing Stones, he's on Orkney. So Anne with us after 3:30 this afternoon. And we'll talk too about that compensation figure of 700 quid that some people who've had car finance might be in line for. First, though, there is no doubt that this is the big, big story of the day, rightly so. Israel's cabinet is meeting to approve the ceasefire meant to end the war in Gaza. Now, after that, the agreement will be passed on to the Israeli government with ratification expected this evening. It comes after a recent diplomatic push from the US, with almost 2,000 Palestinian prisoners being exchanged for the last Israeli hostages. In the last hour, we spoke to the hugely impressive Maoz Inon, who lost his parents in the October the 7th attack. He told us why he welcomed this peace deal.
So what I care the most is that the solution will be a political solution, and not solution that is tried to be achieved on the battlefield and by sacrificing people. And after October 7th, I was furious. I was full of anger and hate and wanted to punish and take my revenge in the Israeli government. But through the work I was doing with my Palestinians, partners and brothers, I learned that I can choose forgiveness. That I can choose forgiveness in order to save my own soul from the destiny those who are accountable for the death of my parents choose for me. And since then, I've been choosing radical forgiveness. I forgive the Israeli government and I forgive Hamas. I care only about the future. And I don't care who will be credit for achieving a lasting peace and learning about conflict areas around the world. That many times peace treaties are being signed by those who only a day before was still killing and massacring innocent people.
Yeah.
And what I care is only about ensuring a future, ensuring a future of reconciliation, a future of equality, and who will be credit for that, I cannot care less.
Really, really impressive man. Maoz Inon talking there about what he calls his radical forgiveness. Well, Bronwyn Maddox is the director and chief executive of the think tank Chatham House. Bronwyn, do you think that that timetable that appears to have been agreed will be stuck to and that everything will go to plan today?
What a question. I think things do seem to be moving. They do seem to be sticking. I think there is a huge amount of support for this phase one. Now on the Israeli side and from all kinds of voices in Israel are putting pressure on the government, but crucially the US putting pressure on the Israeli government. And there is a lot of pressure from the Arab side on Hamas as well. So at this point, it does seem to be moving. And there are an awful lot of fingers crossed and prayers or whatever all across the world, really, that this goes through. But this is there are also many, many potential obstacles, not just in the next 24 hours, but beyond that. So we can't, it's not done till it's done.
Right. I know some commentators are pointing to the Israeli attack on the Hamas representatives in Qatar as being a moment that actually caused an unexpected turn of events in a way and put pressure on the Israelis to actually consider this peace deal. Do you agree with that?
Completely. I think that was the moment when President Trump said, really, I've had enough of what Israel is doing in striking striking a US ally, but striking Hamas leaders as they were at least purporting to be discussing a deal to release the hostages. He had enough. And at that point, he began putting pressure on Israel. And at the same time, many Arab countries, alarmed at the escalation of this, also started putting pressure on Hamas. And you got from different sides the ingredients that have brought us to this point.
Do you think that in the near future, actually, perhaps the very near future, journalists from all over the world will get access to Gaza and will see perhaps the full extent of what appears to be total devastation there? And if that happens, what impact do you think their reporting will have?
They should get access. I spoke at Chatham House to President Herzog of Israel just the day after the Qatar strikes, and I don't think there was a sense then of the significance, but he had a kind of lament for how misunderstood Israel was in aspects of that action, and yet to the riposte, well, why don't you let in journalists or even parliamentarians? It was no at that point. We're going to keep up the controls. First, food needs to get in, food and medical support. This is a disaster zone. But the world also needs, and all sides need, and in fact Israel will benefit from, an accurate account of what has gone on there, but also what now goes on there, because vast amounts of food and then followed by money may be flowing into Gaza, and the best control over what happens there and to make sure that that is distributed fairly is a fairly fierce light of transparency on what now happens.
And what about those members of Hamas? I must admit, this is the part of this very complicated picture that boggles my mind the most. What do you do with the Hamas fighters who, frankly, have known nothing else for their entire adult life? What are they going to do now? Where are they going to go?
It is incredibly hard to answer that question. Very hard, I think, for Hamas to have any part in a future Palestinian government. And that is the next stage of focus. I think, you know, who or what now runs Gaza, and if there are technocrats and President Trump's board of peace or whatever, but still beyond that, who is going to run Gaza and indeed the West Bank. But very hard to have formally Hamas within that. What do you do with these young fighters, though? And as you say, they've been, that is what they have been doing. De-radicalization of all kinds is very, very hard, but it is about giving people, many of them, plural, as well as those fighters, a vision of something different, and that they've got much more to lose by keeping fighting than they do by contributing to that, you know, much more prosperous future. Unfortunately, there are always going to be some people who feel that their glory days were in the fighting and their passion is in the fighting. And it just is a case of trying to get those numbers as small as possible.
And do they, the organisation Hamas, I mean, do they give up all their heavy weaponry? I'm imagining that some of them might be rather worried about the threat posed to them by disgruntled locals who are fed up to the back teeth with Hamas. Presumably they'll want to be able to look after themselves.
I presume they do. Disarmament is always one of the most complex bits of these negotiations, and that's one of those where I don't think we've really got the outlines of what is what might happen yet.
Right. I mean, I think Andrew Neil was talking about this earlier on his programme, The Times at One. This is really only the very, very beginning of an incredibly complicated process, isn't it? And you mentioned who might run Gaza. We know that the name Tony Blair has been in the frame. Is that honestly a goer?
Not for running Gaza, no. For being part of a technocratic international board, presumably including many Arab representatives, which holds the administration of Gaza together while these discussions go on, possibly, yes. He's obviously invested a lot of his life in being an envoy to Palestinian territories, but obviously in the region, he is very much known as the joint protagonist, if I can put it that way, of the Iraq invasion. So, you know, he's got something to contribute, perhaps, and he does have an ability to get some of the Arab countries talking in some circumstances, but they're developing those abilities themselves very much as well.
Right. And the Peace Prize, the notion that Donald Trump might get the Peace Prize, he certainly had an eye on it, and he's been constantly bigging himself up as a Peace Prize prospect. Let's have a listen to the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu talking to Trump in July.
I want to present to you, Mr. President, the letter I sent to the Nobel Prize Committee. It's nominating you for the Peace Prize, which is well-deserved, and you should get it.
Thank you very much. This I didn't know. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming from you in particular, this is very meaningful. Thank you very much, Bibi.
Thank you. Thank you for everything you're doing.
Thank you.
Well, Bronwyn, we heard earlier from our contributor, Mawaz Inon, whose parents had been killed on October the 7th. He said, quite frankly, he didn't care who took responsibility for any sort of peace deal as long as there was one. Do you care whether or not Donald Trump gets the Nobel Peace Prize?
Yeah, I think I've always been a skeptic of the Peace Prize, because peace is pretty fragile and it takes a lot of people to secure it. But some people, and the US president is one of those, care a great deal about it. And I don't think it's meaningless. I think if peace can be made to stick for quite a time, beginning with a year, then he absolutely deserves credit. He deserves credit for having brought it to this point. And it was something that Joe Biden did not do. Here, Joe Biden did have an opportunity to put more pressure on Israel and didn't do it, while laying out a very similar deal. Mm. And put more pressure on Arab countries, to put pressure on Hamas and so on. Trump absolutely deserves credit for getting to this point, but that's not the same thing as a peace prize, because we haven't quite got peace yet. We might have a ceasefire of several hours standing. You know, if you let a year roll on and this has developed into a peace, and Donald Trump talks about a Middle East peace, not just an Israeli-Palestinian one, then I think that that is a real achievement. And while I'm not a fan of the prize, I wouldn't object to those saying at that point he and no doubt others by that point, have done a lot to deserve this.
Yes.
We're not there yet.
No, we're really not there yet. And other people involved in the mix, very much in the mix, Steve Witkoff, property developer, golf buddy of Donald Trump, hugely involved.
And you might throw the Qataris in as well.
Right, the Qataris, and of course, Donald Trump's son-in-law. I mean, I say that, of course, his son-in-law. But in normal times, president's son-in-laws wouldn't be doing work like this, would they?
Well, in lots of countries, that is normal times. It's just not normal in the US that you get quite such a family enterprise. I think one representative from the US is enough. And if this sticks, it will have been driven by Donald Trump. Steve Witkoff will have done quite a lot of the legwork. But, you know, there will be other sides in this as well. You can't usually unilaterally bring about peace.
Roman, thank you.
We're even saying the word peace too much.
Yeah.
We're not there yet.
No, okay. I'm going to be really crude and just ask you, if you were to give this whole plan marks out of 10 for succeeding potentially in being the start of a Middle East peace process, what would you say?
That's quite a complicated question. For being the start of something? Sure, you can give it 10 out of 10 for being the start of something, but whether it actually is something, we're just not there.
Thank you. Bronwyn Maddox, the Director and Chief Executive of the Chatham House think tank.
There is a poll being conducted on thetimes.com. If you'd like to participate, asking whether this will lead to lasting peace, 10,000 or so people have responded already. 84% believe not. Jane and Fee at times.radio is our email address this afternoon and every afternoon. 0333 003 2353 is the WhatsApp. Coming up, are you owed 700 quid because of the car finance scandal? Find out how to claim and how far this goes in just a moment. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Experience award-winning itineraries from aboard small, luxurious ships with Oceania Cruises. Discover the finest cuisine at sea and exquisitely crafted dining experiences. Enjoy gourmet specialty restaurants and open-seat dining at no additional cost. With over 600 destinations to choose from, explore the world with Oceania Cruises. Visit oceaniacruises.com or your travel agent.
Take advantage of the Kia Electric Car Allowance to drive the Kia EV3, this year's UK and World Car of the Year. Or the new EV4, the Times Electric Car of the Year 2025, with a range of up to 388 miles. Get up to £3,750 towards your PCP finance deposit contribution and 3.9% APR representative until the 16th of December. Search the Kia Electric Car Allowance today.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
Range based on test conditions and may vary. T's and C's apply. Kia Finance.
When you're growing a small business, you need someone who understands the ins and outs. And whether you're a tailor or an accountant, you need the tools to succeed. With an HSBC Small Business Banking account, you'll have free accounting tools and access to our business specialists, virtually or in person. Because whatever your small business looks like, we're with you all the way. Search HSBC Small Business Banking account to get started. Subject to application, eligibility, credit check and T's and C's. Visit hsbc.co.uk for details.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms. Helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
We've got a podcast. What do you mean you don't have a podcast? Everybody's got a podcast. Current topics include writing letters from the restroom at work, the rise of Laura Ashley and the ruffle collar, and wearing baseball caps indoors. You can also on the podcast hear all of our 3:30 interviews in full, including the likes of Rick Astley, Ian McEwan and Lise Doucette. And yesterday we spoke to Dame Joanna Lumley. We discussed her new book and also her campaign for justice for the Gurkhas. I asked her if it would have been successful in the current climate surrounding immigration, and she told me she thinks we should be less insular when it comes to migration.
I'm an immigrant. I was born in India. I've got my British papers signed at home to show that I belong. So I'm very wary of all this judging people. I think it's detestable. Our energy in the world should be, again, looking out. We should see why people have to leave faraway countries and prefer to come here. It's usually because of climate change has made their lands untenable, or strife and conflict and hatred and division has made their country unlivable in.
So you can download that episode and many, many, many more. How many do you think there are now, Jane?
Oh, 20 trillion, billion, million. Quite a lot. Genuinely quite a lot.
Yeah, genuinely quite a lot. But they're quite entertaining and many people use them as a sleep aid and apparently it works. Time to shift gears now to talk cars. A special Radiolink badge goes to our producer who wrote that. The city regulator announced this week that people who were missold car finance could get £700 each in compensation. The Financial Conduct Authority says the bill for lenders to pay back victims could reach nearly £10 billion. But how do you know if you're able to claim a payout and how would you go about doing that? With all the answers, it's Holly Mead, host of the Times Feel Better About Money podcast. How do you know if you were missold one of these car finance agreements, Holly?
Well, it's not always easy. And I'm also going to start with an apology because I'm wearing a baseball cap indoors. So I've clearly not listened to the right podcast episode.
Well, I'm sorry, this interview's terminated.
Yes, goodbye.
Goodbye.
No, so this all goes back to mostly involves a type of arrangement. If you bought a car on finance, either through hire purchase or PCP deal, and it was called a discretionary commission arrangement. And this is where the amount of commission that the salesman who sold you your car got for selling that car was not fixed. It instead was linked to the amount of interest they could get you to pay on the finance deal that you took out. So the loan you took out to buy that car. So the higher rate of interest they got to charge you, the more of a kickback they got. Now, this was banned a couple of years ago because the regulator kind of caught up and went, that's not great. And some people were getting ripped off. So this refers to deals between April 2007 and November 2024. And the regulator has estimated that about 14 million car finance deals may be eligible for a compensation because of this, because it was not made clear that their salesman was being compensated in that way. It was hidden, it was obfuscated, it was buried in the contract, and so they were essentially missold.
So the news this week on the story is this £700 payout, isn't it? Which is different to previous payouts because it seems to be something that's going to happen across the board. So how do people know if they might be eligible for it?
Yeah, so £700 is the average amount of compensation that the regulator is estimating that each case will get. It will vary. Now, this is actually under consultation until November. It's not official yet, but it kind of is going to happen. And it's likely that a redress scheme will get going in the early part of next year. Now, it should be that the car finance lender will contact you. So you don't actually need to do anything, and particularly not if you've already lodged a complaint, which millions of people will have done last year when this all first came about. And those complaints have been frozen while the regulator's been deciding what to do about this and whether to set up a redress scheme. So if you have lodged a complaint, then you really can just sit back and that money should find you. If not, firms are supposed to contact you within 6 months of the redress scheme starting. However, it could be, particularly if you were involved in one of those deals going back to 2007, that they just don't have your details anymore. And that might be just because companies don't have to keep records dating back that far, or it might be that your phone number or your address has changed and they can't contact you. So in that instance, you will need to do the legwork and you will need to dig out some proof of your agreement. Hopefully you've got some paperwork buried or an email buried somewhere. But if not, you could provide a bank statement that shows you were making those regular payments, and then you will need to contact the lender. The one thing I would really advise against is using a claims management firm. They are going to be all over this. This is Christmas for claims management firms.
Yes, but they take a huge commission, don't they? And actually, isn't one of the points that the Financial Conduct Authority is trying to make in saying that there will be £700 or thereabouts each in compensation to make people aware of the fact they're going to get this. They don't have to go through a management company to get it.
And it's also why they're being really clear that you shouldn't have to do anything, that this is kind of a sort of sit back and wait for it to come to you, because it's reminiscent of the PPI scandal. And we had a lot of claims management firms involved then promising people thousands of pounds. And, you know, a lot of people did get payouts that they might not have taken the time to get themselves. But these firms will take 30, 40, 50% of anything you are due. And that's kind of wild when they don't really have to do much work for that other than potentially fill in one form. So yeah, don't be tempted. And also, if you did already engage a claims management firm when this all first came about, then you need to dig out the agreement that you had with them. It may be that you can get out of it. You could send them an email or a letter saying you'd like to disengage their services. There might be a clause in there whereby there's some sort of cancellation fee. So you need to read the details there. But essentially, if they haven't done any work on the case yet, they can't really charge you a cancellation fee. So that one might be a little bit of a fight, but it could be worth it if it's an extra few £100 in your pocket.
And Holly, it is worth saying as well, isn't it, that because the car firms have known about this for a very long time, most of the big car manufacturers have actually there is a template available to you, usually via their website, that you can use in order to make the claim. I mean, it's not as if the car industry has been able to hide from this at all, is it?
No, this feels like it should be a pretty undramatic process. So yeah, you can either go to your manufacturer's or your lender's website, or potentially use a resource like Money Saving Expert, and they have a free template there as well that you can use. That's kind of just the letter, and you fill it a bit like Mad Libs. You fill in the details of your own to the template.
Steve's got a question. I bought numerous cars over the period from BMW Finance. Are they liable for each agreement?
Yes, it will be per agreement. And remember, you might not have been sold on a discretionary commission basis. This wasn't all car finance deals. So if you're hoping that Christmas could be catered for already, some people might be left a little bit disappointed.
Okay, but definitely worth checking.
It's worth checking for sure. If you were missold, you should be compensated for that. I think there was an issue here about a year ago where there was talk of just kind of drumming up compensation for every single person who's ever bought a car. That I don't agree with. And I think what we also have to be aware of is there's a huge compensation bill about to hit the car industry. And whatever way you look at it, we will, as a consumers, be picking up that bill in the end.
You're absolutely right, won't we? Consumer Campaign Group Which is taking Apple and Samsung to court, arguing that they engaged in anti-competitive practices. What does this mean for individual people who've got an Apple or a Samsung product?
Yes, I know, it's like compensation day. This one might be slightly less exciting, but essentially, Which, the consumer group, has lodged a class action for anyone who bought a Apple or Samsung mobile phone between 2015 and 2024. And they say essentially that they were passing on costs unfairly, inflated prices and licensing fees to their customers. If you are eligible for this one, you've been automatically opted into that. So again, you shouldn't have to do anything. But £17 is the average payout to expect here. So maybe not one to be waiting by the postbox for.
Right, okay. Just a little bit of Christmas morning is covered by that. Holly, despite your headwear, that's been very informative. Thank you very much indeed. Holly Mead is host of the Times' Feel Better About Money podcast.
Yeah, it is. It's just the hat, Holly. But that, you're right, that was incredibly informative. You are listening to Times Radio, and in the next half an hour, you can just luxuriate, I'm going to say, in the company of the great novelist Anne Cleves. She's got so many fans, written so many great books, inspired so many terrific television series. Anne Cleves has a new Jimmy Perez book out now. It's called The Killing Stones, and you can hear from Anne in a moment or two here on Times Radio after the headlines at 3:30 from Will Hobbs.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. It's 3:30. Israel's government's expected to sign off on the first phase of a Donald Trump-proposed peace deal agreed with Hamas overnight, triggering a ceasefire. World leaders have expressed hope, and there's scenes of celebration in Gaza and Israel. But Reham Auda, a Palestinian and women's rights activist, is being reserved about celebrating just yet.
So we have concerns that after releasing the Israeli hostages, the hands of Hamas at least, maybe there will be a disagreement about the issue of disarming Hamas, about the issue of ruling the Gaza Strip.
Reuters are reporting the hostages may be released as early as Saturday. Madeleine McCann, meanwhile, her sisters told a court a woman claiming to be the missing girl reached out to her on LinkedIn, calling the contact last September extreme. Polish national Julia Wondolt denies stalking the family. Former Radio 1 DJ Tim Westwood has been charged with sexual offences against seven women, including four counts of rape. The charges against the 68-year-old relate to alleged incidents between 1983 and 2016. Communities in Manchester have been told evil will not prevail as a congregation marks 1 week since a terror attack on a synagogue. Two Jewish worshippers were killed in Crumpsall on the holy day of Yom Kippur. And Sir Keir Starmer is looking at allowing pubs to stay open for longer. Downing Street believes outdated licensing rules are holding back the hospitality sector and wants the thoughts of landlords and punters. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
Take advantage of the Kia Electric Car Allowance to drive the Kia EV3, this year's UK and World Car of the Year. Or the new EV4, the Times Electric Car of the Year 2025, with a range of up to 388 miles. Get up to £3,750 towards your PCP finance deposit contribution and 3.9% APR representative until the 16th of December. Search the Kia Electric Car Allowance today.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
Range based on test conditions and may vary. T's and C's apply. Kia Finance.
At Buy Association, we stay one step ahead of the property market, and our team of experts have identified the Halo at Oval Village as London's next landmark home. This stunning development with a coveted Zone 1 postcode offers luxury living overlooking the iconic Oval Cricket Ground. To find out more about 1, 2 and 3 bedroom apartments at the Halo Oval Village, request your free brochure today. Text BA Radio Oval to 66777. By Association, ahead of the market since 2005.
They're bubbly, they're fuzzy, and they're ruddy delicious!
At Oddbox, we rescue farm fresh fruit and veg that's too odd for supermarkets. Then we deliver direct to your door, so every box and every crunch makes a difference to growers and the planet. Use the code RADIO to get 50% off your first box at oddbox.co.uk and help fight food waste, one curvy cucumber at a time. Offer excludes delivery fees, conditions apply.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms. Ready to start your next home project? This autumn at Wickes, there are great kitchen and bathroom offers available. Explore the ranges at wickes.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wickes store.
Now to our big guest of the day, and it's Anne Cleeves, one of our favourite writers. Now, we last interviewed the creator of Ace Detective in a Tatty Raincoat, Vera Stanhope, at the Cheltenham Literature Festival last year, alongside the brilliant actress who brought Vera to life on telly, Brenda Blethyn. Now, this autumn, Anne is back with a new book, and this time she's returned to another of her hugely popular creations, Jimmy Perez, the taciturn and often rather gloomy Shetland detective. I asked Anne if she thought that for a time she'd left old Jimmy behind.
I suppose I did a bit, but because I was convinced that book 8 of the Shetland series would be the last Jimmy Perez, and that I was a bit bored with him and I didn't want to write any more about him. But then I did get a kind of homesickness for the North. I love those Northern Isles. And in the last Shetland book, he moved south to Orkney with his new partner, Willow. And it seemed a good excuse to explore other islands. I first went to Orkney 50 years ago when I first went to Shetland, but I don't know them as well as Shetland, so it was a great opportunity to go back, do a bit of research, stay with a very good friend, Stuart Bain, and explore more of the islands.
I'm really interested in the idea of a writer getting bored
by one of her own creations. Can you just explain that?
I suppose I thought that I'd said all that I wanted to say about Shetland. So it's not really being bored by Jimmy. It's that there are only 21,000 people live in Shetland, in all the islands, maybe up to 23,000 now. And I'd looked at politically at how the islands have changed since oil came and oil went, and at that character and his family. And I really thought I'd come to the end of that story. So really exciting to go back and look at him again and seeing him with new eyes and as a family man and different responsibilities, and he's happier and maybe not quite so boring these days.
Okay. To my shame, do you know, I've never been to Shetland or Orkney. What are the differences?
The thing that everybody says is that Shetlanders are fishermen with a croft and Orcadians are farmers with a boat. So Shetlanders are much more into the water, and the Orkney is much more fertile, it's greener, you can have proper farming instead of subsistence crofting. I think my way of summing it up would be that Orkney is Shetland, but for wimps. Okay. It's gentler and it's easier in lots of ways. It's much closer to the Scottish mainland. Yeah. So it doesn't get quite as dark in winter or quite as light all night in summer.
Okay, because Shetland is a place of extremes, isn't it?
It really is. It's on the same line of latitude as bits of Alaska and Greenland. And Orkney is, it's north too, you know, it's a long way north. It's right off the top of Scotland, but it's not quite as Scandinavian as Shetland is.
Tell me as well about all the links to, prehistory in place. I mean, this is why I love your books, as you know. I'm also a big fan of Ellie Griffiths and her books, where she has so much pre and ancient history in her writing. And I just love all that stuff. We are so irrelevant, aren't we? But we take ourselves so seriously.
I love the whole Orkney thing because, yeah, there's lots of Neolithic remains. And I was lucky enough to go into Maes How, which is an ancient burial chamber shaped almost like an igloo. And at the winter solstice, if it's clear, I mean, how did they build it? How did they know? The light comes in as the sun's sinking, the light just hits the very narrow entrance. And again, I was very lucky because people go time and time again, but it's cloudy and they don't see the light come in. But you saw it just as a little trickle of gold, almost like a small liquid river. And then it gets wider and wider until it hits the back of the chamber. But what was really fascinating about Maes How is that, so you've got this Neolithic building, but you get all the Nordic graffiti, so Viking graffiti. The runes on these ancient stones that the Vikings came and left their mark as well.
And they're still there?
They're still there, yeah. And people can decipher them, I think.
That is incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you do use it in this book. Mm. I don't want to give too much away.
No.
But it's very hard, I imagine, to visit a location like that, and if you're a great writer, not to be inspired by it.
Yeah, it's very special. I was very lucky. I went at midwinter. It was clear and frosty and cold. And what's completely magic about Orkney are the views, because you see land and you see loch and then you see more land and then you see the sea. And it's just a stunning landscape. And in the frost and clear and not too many visitors. And going round with the local who grew up in Westray and whose parents still farm there made it enchanting, really.
Farming there, well, I mean, tough probably doesn't quite do it justice. What is it like?
I think because the land is so fertile and Orkney is very famous for its beef and Westray, which is the island where they live, is quite a wealthy island because lots of the fishing boats go out from there. So it's a great community. And I was able to, I stayed in the Pierre Wall Hotel, which features in the book, and went to the Heritage Centre and went to the Northland archaeological dig. So did all those things. And you need to walk in the on the land to be able to write about them.
Well, did they welcome you? Because they are going to put two and two together and think, well, Anne Cleves is here. She's spending a lot of time poking around in our business. And it's quite clear that there's going to be a murder involved.
I think they were delighted because there's a real rivalry between especially Orkney and Shetland libraries. And Stuart, who I was staying with, I don't know if you remember, but many years ago, Orkney Library had the most irreverent, funny tweets. It had a huge Twitter account for the size of the library. Right. And Stuart was the library assistant who did all those tweets. So Shetland Library, when they heard what I was doing, there was a picture of Stuart looking like an advert from Traitors, the traitor.
Right, okay.
They so just very funny comments flying backwards and forwards.
The people of Shetland have forgiven you for temporarily perhaps deserting them for the charms of Orkney.
Yes, I think we just think it's a bit of fun.
Okay, well, I wouldn't want any, wouldn't want any trouble. Jimmy, in the centre of this book, is that Jimmy's friend, a man called Archie Stout, has been murdered. Mm. And this is difficult because Jimmy knows this man. And we want to keep all the magic for the readers, but he's not an easy chap, is he, Mr. Stout?
No, he's one of those charismatic people that you like immediately and who are charming and you want to be their friend, and then you find out that maybe they're not quite as reliable as you would hope, or quite as honest or honourable as you would hope. So, yeah, so very mixed feelings Jimmy has for Archie. He loved him like a brother, really loved him. But during this investigation, he comes to realise that he has faults too, and faults that he probably knew and had seen but had deliberately tried to forget and not see.
I think that's why I enjoyed the book, because it did. We all have people like that. If not in our lives, we have come across them. And they are intoxicating. They're great fun to be around.
Yeah.
But there is always a part of your brain that's thinking, I kind of know he's a wrong un. Or she is.
Yeah. And not always a wrong un. We all make mistakes and he does bad things, but he also has a kindness about him too, I think.
Well, it just complicates the picture, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But then that is life. So you said you had to go back to the north. Obviously, Matthew Venn is your character in Devon. Vera operates in the Northumbrian countryside, Northumberland. Yeah. And you've got Orkney. But I was startled to read that you actually are from Herefordshire.
Yeah, until I was 11, I lived in Herefordshire. My dad was a village school teacher, a village head teacher.
Which village in Herefordshire?
It was called Adfordton. It was a hamlet between Leinster and Ludlow, near Lentwerdine, Lentwerdine and Wigmore.
Okay.
So that very much the border country.
And you've never set anything there, because I know a bit about it because I did my local radio years in Herefordshire and Worcestershire.
Mm.
It's really underrated parts of England, I think. I really love both of those counties. But you could set something in the border country between England and Wales.
I don't know it well enough, though. I moved when I was 11, I moved, and I do get a bit, I feel a bit scared when I'm inland. I like being on the edge. A sense that I can escape if I need to somehow. It's very odd sort of sensation. But I certainly wouldn't want to live back in Herefordshire.
Oh, really?
No.
Okay, well,
too far for the sea.
Oh, so when did you come to that realisation that you were someone who had to be by the coast?
I think very soon after we moved to North Devon, I just felt suddenly at home. Partly it was because it was a very small school, 30 kids, 15 infants, 15 juniors in one room with a curtain down the middle. And if your dad is the teacher, it's quite hard to make friends. And I remember, just looking back, I only see that time in black and white and grey. It's very, very odd. And when we moved to North Devon, it was as if suddenly the sun came out. And I still have really close friends that I went to in Barnstable.
I think I can't imagine what it would be like to be taught by a parent. How could you go under the radar? Well, you couldn't, could you?
No. And you can't be shown favour. So even if you didn't do it, if someone blames you for doing something, you probably cop it. because that's the way it is.
In this new book, the younger generation feature quite heavily, and I don't know about you, I think it's probably tougher to be a teenager now to try to navigate the worlds that you have to inhabit, because you've got the real world and then you've got your other world. What do you think about what it must be like?
Absolutely, it must be so hard. And there's so much more pressure, I think, at school now, with Ofsted and teachers being judged and valued by their results, so they're putting pressure on kids too. And COVID, the whole lockdown thing, meant there was a whole couple of years when children were mostly on their own and were told to look at screens, and now we're telling them not to. And I think especially for those island, the outer island children who go to a... I know Fair Isle very well. It's just the smallest of the inhabited Shetland Islands. That you go to school on the island and there are probably four or five kids in the school and you're probably related to a couple of them. And then when you're aged 11, you move out and you go to the big school in Kirkwall if you're in Orkney,
yeah,
or Lerwick if you're in Shetland.
And you have to board, don't you?
You have to board, yeah, because you can't get home.
I think that must be incredibly difficult.
Hard for them and hard for the parents. I think most island kids grow up knowing that's how it's going to be. Mm. And most have family on Shetland mainland or Orkney mainland too, who are, look after them. And in the book, Jimmy Perez and Willow take in one of Archie's children and make sure that they're looked after. And so it's the whole thing about it takes a village to bring up a child, I suppose.
Did you speak to many of the children or the teenagers on Orkney when you were...
Not on Orkney, but I certainly did in Shetland when I first started writing about there, because Raven Black, the first of the Shetland books, is about that. It is about that... How I don't think there's a teenager who feels that they fit in and they belong, especially teenage girls. They're either too fat or too thin, or they don't listen to the right music, or they don't understand the right references in social media. And I think in a sense it's always been that way, but it's much, as you say, it's much harder now. And harder for boys too, because there are so many conflicting messages. If you're looking at computers and you see that dreadful Andrew Tate, or you see... Or maybe you've got sisters who are bullying you because they're not... You're not using the right words, or you're not treating them properly. Mm. It must be, I've got grandchildren. I can remember a grandson looking at his sister and saying, "Was it all right to say that? Well, I wasn't being sexist there, was I?" Desperate not to get it wrong, and it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, if you had to choose, would you rather be female or male as a teenager in 2025?
I think in one way it's easier to be female. Mm. I really do. And I think I don't think we have demonised boys, but I think some boys feel that they are demonised when they're desperate not to put a foot wrong.
And into that space move people like Tate.
Yes.
And it's fertile territory.
It is, yeah.
And what do you... You must be saddened, as I think a lot of people are, about the decline in reading, in enjoyment of reading in adolescence. But I'm genuinely not sure how we change that when they... To be blunt about it, I just didn't have the options, Anne, and I was so happy with Swallows and Amazons,
yeah,
that I wasn't seeking anything else out.
I think we're starting to pull back, but I think the whole emphasis on spelling and grammar in English classes in school did so much harm. I can remember going into school and doing a workshop and being followed round by this literacy expert, and I got the kids all fired up and they were talking about what they read and they were going to write a story, and we'd set up a crime scene in a corner. And this woman was following them around, asking them about adverbs and prepositions.
And you'd say, what's the alternative? Forget that?
Yeah, forget it. You can edit that later. Get the story down. Bring back the joy in reading. And this is a passion of mine. Books should be available to everybody, whether you can afford them or not. Yeah. So why are we closing libraries? We know there was an OECD report years ago which said that reading for pleasure was a higher indicator of academic success than parental income or status. If we're serious about giving everybody equal opportunities, that means we need to make books available to all our kids books that they're reading for pleasure, not just snippets to be read for part of a comprehension exercise.
And what about the idea of banning smartphones in schools?
I don't see why kids would need a smartphone in school. I mean, I think parents actually are quite paranoid about wanting to know where their children are, so they want them to have a phone when they leave school in case they get lost on the way home. I think it's highly unlikely that they would, but I think it's a really fine balance, isn't it?
Well, it is, because we have all, as parents and grandparents, become more paranoid than our own parents.
Yeah, nobody knew where we were when we were out roving.
Well, to be honest, Anna, I was always meal dependent, so I never strayed too far. Because I needed to get a sandwich.
Me too. Yeah.
I'm never entirely sure, and you can correct me. Did we really leave the house and roam around on the red wreck or whatever it was all day?
Not all day, no. But I don't think, I'm thinking of adolescence, the sort of adolescent age of some of the characters in the book. I was drinking underage in pubs, and because the pubs knew us,
yeah,
we were probably a lot safer than kids who are trying to blag their way into clubs or who are just hanging around in underpasses because there's nowhere else for them to go, drinking cider or smoking weed. So I think my parents didn't know I was up to all that.
No. Well, you've not done badly for yourself.
Yeah, university dropout. I've done all right.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, you dropped out because?
Because I was at Sussex at a time when Sussex was really quite...
It was quite radical, wasn't it?
Radical, yeah, but also... So, and I came from rural North Devon, and I'd taken a gap year working with troubled kids in Camden. So I'd lived in London for a bit. And sitting around talking about Keats just seemed a bit irrelevant. But also, it was vanity because I was coming home on the bus back to the flat that I was sharing. And I heard someone say, "Oh, Anne, yes. She's the one that looks as if she's just come off the farm, isn't she?"
Ooh.
So I thought, I don't think I fit in here.
Yeah. Do you look at your book sales now and contemplate that individual just every now and again?
Oh, it's, you know, I was probably bitchy about other people too. So,
oh, and you're too decent. You're too decent by half. So your avid readers will want to know which character you're going to focus on next, or do you have something new in the mix?
No, next is Matthew Venn, and he'll come out next autumn, so 2026, and I'm already thinking about the very last Vera novel.
So it's coming.
It is coming.
We haven't heard the last. We might have seen the last.
Yeah.
We haven't heard the last of Vera.
No, definitely not.
Is she still very much in her neck of the woods, though?
Yeah, absolutely. Up in Northumberland, which is where up in my bit of the country.
So there we go. That was Anne Cleeves delighting us all there with the news that we haven't heard the last of Vera Stanhope in book form. She is going to delight us once more. And her character, Matthew Venn, who is the Devon-based detective, will be her next project. You can hear about that book, perhaps on this programme if you're lucky, maybe this time next year. But the one we're focusing on for now is her latest book about Jimmy Perez, and that's The Killing Stones, and that's out now.
We have got some amazing crime writers coming up on the programme as well. If you're a fan of Three Pines, then Louise Penny will be right up your street. She's on over the next month or so. And Peter James as well, who is a prolific author. You probably know him best for his Grace series, and that's televised now, isn't it? Mm. It's on the ITV, on the other side there, Jane.
It's on the other side, so I'm not that familiar with it.
But his latest crime piece featuring Grace is all about an attempted assassination of Queen Camilla. It is written because Peter James is an enormous fan of the work that the Queen has done for literacy, and I believe knows her, so it's absolutely with her knowledge that this has been written. But it's quite it's a very, very intriguing read, because obviously he is describing a person who we all believe that we already know, but it's within a fictional context. It's clever.
Wow, okay. That sounds very interesting. Coming our way soon. Guests next week on the programme include Catherine Jenkinson, who is an investigative journalist who's done a lot of work on the rise of the far right and the incel movement. Catherine Jenkinson, have I got that right? Still haven't. I do apologise. Catherine Jenkinson, to be fair to me, it's a relatively uncommon name. She'll be with us next week. It's certainly going to be interesting, that. And also the very successful historical novelist Philippa Gregory will join us too. And then where do we find ourselves on Thursday?
We are at the Cheltenham Literature Festival. We are delighted to be going back to Cheltenham, and we will be interviewing Penny Lancaster, who has a memoir out. We'll talk about loads of things live on stage.
Yes, I think just to help the audience there, we'll have to wear those special badges with our names on, because a lot of people were going to think, oh, there's three women on that stage. Which one is the supermodel, and which one is Fee, and which one is Jane? So we'll wear badges.
You're absolutely right. It will be very, very tricky for people to be able to tell. I mean, at least if Rod Stewart's in the front row, should we get him to wear a badge too?
Penny's partner. That's what his badge will say. OK, so that is next week. Come along, if you can, to the Cheltenham Literature Festival. We'll be in a beautifully appointed marquee talking to Penny Lancaster next Thursday. It is now 4 minutes to four.
In the ever-changing world of current affairs, nothing stands still. Times Radio Breakfast is your essential weekend briefing with incisive analysis on all the latest developments in politics, culture and entertainment. Plus, all the latest financial news with the Weekend Money Check. Times Radio Breakfast with Chloe Tilley and Callum McDonald, Saturday and Sunday mornings from 6 on Times Radio with Handels Banken. Banking done differently since 1871. Find out why at handelsbanken.co.uk.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Can your phone drown out irritating noises in your videos? Can anybody hear me over this? Luckily, Audio Eraser on the Galaxy S25 Ultra gets rid of background noises in seconds. Can your phone do that? Galaxy can. Get 15% off Galaxy S25 Ultra with code S15.
Buy from Samsung.com by the 21st of October 2025. Use code at checkout. Voucher code can't be combined with any other offer. Samsung account login and network connection required. Certain types of noise can be detected. Accuracy not guaranteed.
What makes you feel good?
A hot cup of tea.
The smell of freshly cut grass.
Switching the home insurance with AgeCo feels good. They're owned by Age UK and give their profits to the charity. And there's no extra cost for paying monthly.
Switch with AgeCo today for insurance you can feel good about. Visit ageco.co.uk to get your quote now. Home insurance provided by Liverpool Victoria Insurance Company Limited.
Hiya, I'm Mike. Colleague here at Asda Pillsworth, and I've got some big news to share with you about all the incredible prices I've seen in store. So turn up the volume now.
Wowza, Mike. That's right, because Asda have got over 3,000 rollbacks across the store and online to help lower the cost of your weekly shop.
That's good, honest value.
That's Asda price. Selected stores and lines. Subject to availability. Excludes Asda Express and small stores. See asda.com/small stores.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
By the way, we're with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Thanks for your remarks on Anne Cleves. One listener just thought she was delightful as an interviewee. Well, thank you. She's just a lovely woman, and she's had a lot of success. But honestly, considering some of the big-headed types you encounter in the dizzying world of showbiz, Anne is properly lovely. She really is. Matt says Orkney also has seaweed-eating sheep. It's a great place. Simon says, I've got a business on Orkney and I go there often. I've been to Shetland once. I don't agree that Orkney is Shetland for wimps, which is something that Anne said in the course of that conversation. Farmers in Orkney don't have boats. The tides are the fastest in the UK. Much of the sailing is extremely dangerous. Both places are very windy and there are no trees.
So it's challenging.
Yeah, properly challenging. Yeah.
And Glyn has got a recommendation for you on your love of the Herefordshire border country. On the Black Hill by Bruce Chatwin is a beautiful book set there.
one of Glynn's all-time favourites. Have you read that?
I haven't, but I'm very grateful for the recommendation. Thank
you should
you,
lose Glynn. Yourself in it this weekend.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to lose myself in Penny Lancaster's memoir, if you don't mind. That's because she's going to be with us, as we've already said, on Thursday in Cheltenham. Really looking forward to that. Weather looks lovely for the next week or so, certainly in the south of England. Hope that hasn't offended you, that statement. It's just very autumnal and fresh and gorgeous and sunny. So have a lovely weekend, and thanks to Rosie and Ryan today.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Jane. It's 4 o'clock and I'm John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive. And here are the headlines. Keir Starmer has welcomed the ceasefire deal for Gaza as Israel is expected to sign off the plan. And vigils have been held to commemorate a week since the attack at a synagogue in Manchester. Coming up, we're going to be following all in Israel and the Middle East. I'll be talking to a former Foreign Office chief, to a hostage family member, and we are expected to hear from President Trump ahead of a cabinet meeting at the White House very, very soon.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Will Hobbs.
Thanks, John. Good afternoon. The Israeli government says a ceasefire in Gaza will begin within 24 hours of its cabinet meeting this afternoon. Israel and Hamas signed the first phase of a peace plan in Egypt this morning, though there are still plenty of unknowns, including around the future of Hamas's weapons and the governing of Gaza. Madeleine McCann's sisters told the court she knew immediately Julia Wondolt wasn't the missing girl, despite her claiming to be. The defendant, who is a Polish national, denies stalking the McCann family. The dad of a man who killed two Jewish worshippers in a synagogue has called for unity 1 week after the terror attack in Manchester. Vigils and moments of silence have been held across the country. Former Radio 1 DJ Tim Westwood has been charged with sexual offences against seven women, including 4 counts of rape. The charges against the 68-year-old relate to alleged incidents between 1983 and 2016. And pubs in England and Wales could stay open for longer, and it could be easier for them to host live music. Downing Street starting a review of licensing rules. For a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with Barclays Corporate Banking.
Welcome to Drive on Times Radio. I'm John Pienaar. It is good to have your company. Now, we are watching the White House, where the President of the United States is due very shortly to chair a meeting of his cabinet. It'll be the first opportunity for the President to give a detailed response to the events, the very fast-moving events, which have now delivered a ceasefire plan and agreement on a longer-term future for Palestine and the Middle East. It is indeed quite a moment. We'll be watching that and bringing that to you live as it takes place. And meanwhile, I mean, how difficult must it be to try to put ourselves into the shoes, into the minds of those families, the loved ones of the hostages in Gaza, and the many more Palestinians who will see their children sleep tonight knowing they will be alive in the morning. I find it very difficult to put myself in that position. I'm sure you do too. Is it even really possible? But that is the true measure of what has now been agreed after those negotiations between the United States, Israel and Hamas, with the Arab world looking on and pushing for the deal, which is now about to be approved by the Cabinet of Israel and the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. That meeting, we understand, is taking place pretty much as I speak. And as the plan sits, there's to be the ceasefire coming into effect within 24 hours of that Israeli cabinet agreement. So stay with us. We will listen to Donald Trump. We'll bring you the news of that ceasefire as it is finally confirmed. And through the day, I'm going to be talking here on the programme to, well, on so many sides of this story, to a hostage family member. I'll be talking to American players in the world of diplomacy, including a hostage negotiator. We'll be talking to Israeli people from the government, formerly of the government, and the IDF, all of whom will give us a fresh perspective on this developing story on the programme this afternoon. So let's just recap on where we are now. President Trump, of course, learned about the deal last night. We now have all seen, haven't we, those pictures, those scenes. Have a listen.
Yeah, I was just given a note by the Secretary of State saying that we're very close to a deal in the Middle East.
And that was a very straightforward announcement from the President, who'll be expanding on that very, very shortly. The Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, who is on his visit to India, he, of course, welcomed the peace deal.
This will come as a profound relief for the hostages and their families and the civilian population in Gaza and for the whole world. And we will now work with our partners to ensure that this deal is implemented in full and without delay.
Keir Starmer speaking in India. And the Secretary-General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, has said this.
I commend the diplomatic efforts of the United States, Qatar, Egypt and Turkey in brokering the desperately needed breakthrough. We have all waited far too long for this moment. Now we must make it truly count.
Right, now let us first of all speak to Gabriel Weininger, the Times correspondent in Israel. Welcome to you, Gabriel.
Hi, John.
Hi, thank you for joining us, Gabriel. Can you tell us first, where are we with the progress towards a ceasefire? Hostilities are still taking place, even as the cabinet meets to formally sign off the ceasefire. Is that right?
That's right. And that's something that we've seen in previous ceasefire deals, whether temporary or not. We've seen Israel fight until the last moment. And we've had at least 10 Palestinian deaths in the past 24 hours. That being said, the Security Cabinet is about to approve the deal. And once that's approved and the ceasefire goes into effect, all hostilities will cease. Israel will begin its withdrawal from Gaza within the next 24 hours, and the hostages will be released within 72 hours. So it's all happening really, really quickly. In order to get it done, I think, and to strike while the iron's hot and to use that momentum to wrap up this long and terrible, terrible war.
And it is a pretty general and fair assessment, Gabriel, that we're now looking at a more solidly based ceasefire than those that we've seen before.
I think that's the hope. There is a lot of scepticism. There is a lot of mistrust. Hamas and Israel, this war isn't new between them. So, you know, we've heard that Gideon Saar, for example, he's the foreign minister, he told Fox News that Israel doesn't intend to resume the war. But we do know that this is the first phase. So we know what's set in stone, the hostage release, the withdrawal to the first security line, what's known as the yellow line, away from urban centres, away from Gaza City, away from the Netzarim corridor, which splits the north and the south of Gaza. But the next steps towards a lasting peace something that's going to take much, much longer to agree upon. And it could fall apart. I think it would be a mistake to assume that everything's now roses. And, you know, what Trump said in that initial press conference, that there will be hopefully eternal peace in the Middle East. That is still quite a long way off.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many ways that this 20-point plan can come unstuck at pretty much each and every step along the way. But at the moment, we do have this imminent ceasefire is how we should describe it. There seems to be confidence that it will now take place. I know this is a complex picture for me to ask you to paint, Gabriel, but just give me a sense of what it must be like in Israel now, the emotional scenes among the hostage families as the formalities are gone through by the leaders and the politicians of Israel.
I think you put it really well, actually, that you're right, this is happening. It's past the point of no return now. This is the beginning, hopefully, of the end. The mood in Israel has been really special today. I think the fact that all the hostages are being released at once is a huge relief for people that this is going to be over for them. And that is the main reason why the Israeli public want to end the war, to see the return of the hostages. There is still concern, for example, for their border.